I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Derek Hayes joins me again. He has just published a remarkable book, Iron Road West, an illustrated history of British Columbia's railway. It's a striking book, comprehensive in its account of the railroads in this province, talking about the many factors in their creation, their history and future, political, social, and economic. The railroad shaped British Columbia and the creation of Vancouver, let alone this country, is without question. Derek's book illuminates that for us with the detail and color of history in this book that also features stunning photographs, archival, as well as those shot that he shot himself. Derek Hayes is a geographer by training and the author of the best-selling Historical Atlas series, which includes the Historical Atlas of Canada, Historical Atlas of Vancouver and the Lower Fraser Valley, Historical Atlas of Toronto, and Historical Atlas of Early Railways. He was also a planner with the Vancouver City Planning Commission and worked as a real estate consultant. He was first on this program in 2016 when his book, Canada, An Illustrated History Revised and Expanded, was released. This new book, Iron Road West, is from Harbor Publishing. He joins me from White Rock, British Columbia. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Derek Hayes. Mr. Hayes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Illuminate in the book just how fierce the competition was at Confederation in terms of the different firms, the different companies, just how much money was to be made here, as well as the corruption. I mean, it just seems to me, as I'm reading the book, such a lively time and one that we tend to overlook. Just how did rail change British Columbia, especially after Confederation?
Well, tremendously. I mean, for a start, British Columbia probably wouldn't be part of Canada if it hadn't been for the railway, the CPR, which reached Vancouver in 1887. Once the CPR was here, of course, they were given a lot of land grants, as we know, including most of what is today Vancouver, and that made it tremendously difficult for anybody who wanted to compete with them to service Vancouver at all. So there was a big competition, if you like, to try and find a way into Vancouver, and of course for the transcontinentals across the mountains. It's quite well known that when the Canadian Northern, as it was before it was Canadian National, tried to build the transcontinental, they had to, in the Fraser Canyon, for example, keep crossing to the other side of the river to get out of the way of the CPR track, because there was only room for one track. But of course that made it much more difficult, much more expensive to build, and of course it was one of the reasons which led to the demise of Canadian Northern and its nationalization.
Right. You mentioned the land, and I guess land speculation is something that we're all talking about nowadays. But I guess it really was fueled by the railway expansion back then, right?
Yes, I mean the railways were everything, because the road system really wasn't developed, and of course in the 1880s, 1890s, there really weren't any automobiles at all. I mean, it's just a completely different situation to what it is today. I always like the story of how the other railways managed to find their way into Vancouver, which was by progressively filling in the eastern end of Falls Creek, which was, basically there was no land to be had, so they created land and persuaded the city of Vancouver to, first the Great Northern, filled in the perimeters of the eastern end of Falls Creek. This is the area now east of Main Street.
Right.
And then the Canadian Northern came along and persuaded them to let them fill in the whole center of it. So basically had a major reclamation project in order to find terminals for those railways.
Yeah, I read somewhere else not too long ago that they were going to actually fill in all of Falls Creek from, say, where Science World is now to...
There have been proposals for that, but luckily they never... came to anything. What would Vancouver be without Falls Creek?
Indeed. Speaking of geography, I mean, the terrain, obviously, throughout British Columbia has been a challenge. It's not easy to navigate, let alone build in and around the mountains and the sort. Some of the photos in the book just show how precarious a lot of it is. There's a wonderful photo by the photographer R.H. Truman in the book. I guess, is that right, near Sandon?
Yes. Well, we owe a lot to those guys, those pioneer photographers, because without them we'd have, no record, no visual record at all. But because the standards were much lower, they just basically wanted to get a line through in the Sandon case to mineral deposits that were a valuable freight for them. They wanted to get the line through at all costs, and they would certainly cut corners in order to do it. They also would fight the opposition. SoCan and Caslow Railway employees, which was Great Northern controlled, ripped up the station and some of the tracks and overturned some boxcars of the CPR because the valley was very narrow and there wasn't really room for two railways, but. So they had to basically fought it out, and they basically literally did that.
Right.
The thing is that in BC the majority of the traffic wanted to go from east to west to the coast, but the mountain ranges are predominantly north to south, right? So the whole sort of story of railway development in British Columbia is about finding ways through the mountains or round the mountains or across the mountains or whatever, and that's why you get, for example, with the CPR, the very steep grades that they started with, because again they wanted to get the line through at all costs, so they could start generating some revenue, because they were deeply in debt at that point. So they had the big hill just by Field in eastern British Columbia, on the east the west slope of the Rockies had a 4.4% grade and special rules and regulations for that stretch with a sort of escape lane type tracks to stop runaway trains and lots of deals with helper locomotives and so on. It split trains up into sections. And that went on until 1909, when they finally got around, managed to halve the grade by building the spiral tunnels, which of course is another thing on itself, right? A big engineering project that was modeled on the Gotthard Tunnel in Switzerland.
Right. You mentioned the archival photos that you use in the book. It just makes for such a beautifully illustrated book. But there are also photos that you took yourself, right?
Yes, all the modern, more or less all the modern photographs are on my own, yes.
Yeah. What was the most fun for you in terms of putting this book together, Iron Road West?
Well, the whole thing was fun. I mean, that's why I'm doing it at this stage in my life. But it's the thing was, I was trying to create a different type of book that not only included the early history, but also the sort of modern history, if you like, the post-war history, the development of things like Roberts Bank, the line to Roberts Bank, and the use of the changeover to bulk railways, bulk freight as a way for the railways to survive the loss of passengers, and all that sort of thing. Plus, what I've called the legacy of the railways in BC, which means is a survey of all the running heritage railways. The museums, all the places you can see traces of railways now. To me, that's one of the more interesting things, is how you can see in the landscape today places where trains ran for 100 years ago and haven't run for that long since, and yet you can still see quite clearly, a bump in the road or whatever where they crossed it.
But by the way, how have we done in terms of the preservation of railway history? I mean, you mentioned that we can see either places in Vancouver where I could go see, cars and engines and the sort. Have we done well in this province in terms of preserving that history?
Well, not too bad compared to other places. I actually do compare the situation here with Britain, which is a very railway mad place where they have lots and lots of heritage railways and so on. But if you compare that on a per capita basis, the population of Britain is, many times what the population of BC is. So on a per capita basis, we've actually done better than Britain. So a lot of the locomotives preserved are logging locomotives because they tended to get sort of left in the bush, if you like, because they eventually lost value. The steam locomotives, when they turned over to diesel or just simply moved on to other pastures as far as logging was concerned. So you've got, for example, on Vancouver Island, half a dozen places where there are preserved logging railways, static displays, unfortunately, but nonetheless in quite good condition.
Yeah, the book's also a great guide if you want to go seek some of the stuff out, the places that you can see.
Yeah, I hope so, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned passenger rail, and one of the fascinating things in the book are the photographs of some of the ephemera, the advertising over the years, just how I guess tourism was sort of built up through a lot of this. When the railroads came through British Columbia, did that start then as well?
Oh, absolutely. The Canadian Pacific was, of course, they were anxious to generate traffic anywhere they could. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they were traversing these rocky mountains that were such a confounded nuisance as far as railway building was concerned. So they thought, well, we might as well make an asset of it, if you like. And so they promoted it for tourists. And, of course, a lot of people in eastern Canada, eastern United States, hadn't been to the Rockies at all at that time. So it was a big adventure, and certainly they promoted it. And of course, they built the hotels that in various strategic locations, so that people could stay there. Mm-hmm. Because they had to basically start from scratch. There's nowhere there at all. And later on, Canadian National did the same thing. They promoted something called the Triangle Tour, which was the triangle of railway from the border of eastern border of British Columbia from Jasper to Prince Rupert, and then by company steamer down to Vancouver, and then back along the Fraser Canyon route to the border. So you could sort of make a whole, well, not circular tour, but triangular tour of British Columbia as a tourist.
Now, could one today, I mean, I guess it would be impossible today to see the province by rail. Right.
Yes. Well, you weren't going to see it by bus, that's for sure,
that's
or plane,
true.
Or anything else. I mean, rail was really your only option if you wanted to see the Rockies. Yeah.
Yeah. Could it be viable again as an industry, perhaps?
Well, it is. The Rocky Mountaineer is doing precisely that.
Yeah.
It's a sort of luxury rail tourism, as it's known, and it's immensely popular. I like to compare it to the river cruises in Europe, you know, where they've got lots of rivers, so they have these very luxurious river cruise boats, and the Rocky Mountaineer is based on that, only on a railway, and they stop in Kamloops overnight, and that, so they're always traveling during the day, and it's a great way for people to actually see the Rockies in comfort.
There's a great shot at the end of the book. It's in White Rock, and it's a statue. I guess there was a train station there at one point. Is that right?
Well, there still is the train station. Physically, it's not used as a station. It's the White Rock Museum.
Right, right. And so how long has it been since a train stopped there?
Oh, geez. A last train stopped there in 1972, I think it was, something like that. I don't quote me on the exact date, but it's not for a long time. The problem being in that particular location that it needed a customs station as well, right? Being the first port of entry into Canada, and that of course adds a layer of cost that is and remains a problem. I mean, there's a movement now to get the Amtrak train from Seattle to stop in White Rock, but there are these customs issues. That's the trouble.
Yeah, well, I take it to go to Seattle all the time, and back, and I always wonder why, because I don't get to White Rock often. It would be a great way to see White Rock from, you know, living in Vancouver.
White Rock owes its existence to the railway. Again, you know, it was developed as a summer resort, which was made accessible by the railway from Vancouver. And people used to come out here for the family would come out for a couple of weeks, and the husband, who was still working in downtown Vancouver, would come out just for the weekends on the train.
You also talk in the book about commuter trains, public transportation. A lot of people, even to this day, even though it's stopped, I guess, in 1950 and 58, the interurban, people are still talking about that. Has there been, I mean, there has been talk since its end about bringing that back, hasn't there?
Indeed. The Fraser Valley Heritage Railway, which is the interurban heritage railway based at Cloverdale, has plans for expansion that were going to take them as far as Newton, were going to connect with the new light rapid transit that Surrey had planned until just recently, when it got cancelled. So that kind of messed that plan up. You've got this existing rail line that goes all the way to Chilliwack, and it is used. It's still used. It's the Southern Railway of British Columbia, but it's used only for what you might term occasional freight. It's not certainly not heavily used, but it does service a lot of industries along the way. But it has definite potential as a commuter line, although. See, the big issue with those kinds of things these days is where it crosses the roads at grade. Potentially an issue. You'd have to have traffic light systems and so on, which tend to muck up the traffic flow on the roads, of course. So it's a bit of a trade-off. You really need it not to be at grade, but that adds a tremendous new cost if you do that.
I guess it shows just how much we've changed in our society, that screwing up traffic and the sort of considerations that unfortunately prevent a lot of rail from happening nowadays, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the stupidest thing imaginable that Vancouver got rid of streetcars in the 50s. And eventually the interurban as well. I mean, we had this whole system of lines that would be the envy of any city in the world today. And we got rid of it and put on buses, or at least trolley buses in some cases. But you know, basically we had the system and we threw it away.
A lot of us remember, I remember as a kid taking the Royal Hudson with the family going, you know, from, I guess it was, you took it in Vancouver and then you went up to Squamish, right?
Yes, that was a program instigated by the provincial government. The Premier of British Columbia between 1970 and 75, Dave Barrett, was instrumental in preserving that locomotive for tourist use. He was the one who got the province to buy it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a beautiful train, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and it's of course still around. It's in the West Coast Railway Association Museum in Squamish, but it needs a new boiler. Steam locomotives unfortunately need to be recertified every, I think it's 10 years, and to make sure they're safe, of course, because you've got high pressure steam there. Uh-huh. And that has what used to be a relatively routine procedure, because there's so few locomotives now, it's become a multi-million-dollar exercise every time it needs to be done. So the Royal Hudson is not likely to get going again until they've raised a lot more money.
Yeah. The other thing that I was thinking about, Derek, as I'm reading your book, is because in and around Vancouver, you obviously see the Amtrak and the sort, but I mean, rail is still used to transport goods and resources. It's still a significant part of the economy, isn't it?
Oh, it is indeed. If you go down to Roberts Bank, for example, you see these 2-kilometer-long trains with double-stack containers on them, or coal trains that are the same sort of length with multiple locomotives, distributed power, as it's called. They put locomotives at the end and in the middle in order to be able to make the trains longer. it's huge business, a big business, and it's vital to the Canadian economy or the North American economy, right. Really. I mean, trains from the coal fields in Wyoming, I think it is, come up by BNSF trains through White Rock, in fact, to Roberts Bank and dump their coal. In fact, there's a big photo, double-page photo in the book of BNSF trains at the coal rotary coal dumper in Roberts Bank, West right. Shore Terminals.
Yeah, and if you, as I mentioned a moment ago, I take the Amtrak to Seattle a few times a year. And it's often the 4 hours or so from Vancouver to Seattle, the train has to stop for other BNSF trains, right?
Yes, that's right. It's not given the priority. I mean, the tracks are owned by the freight railway, not by Amtrak, and that's a problem pretty well everywhere. I mean, it's a problem in Vancouver with the West Coast Express, right? I mean, that runs on commuter line, that runs on CP tracks, and only runs in the morning and the evening because the rest of the time it's needed for freight.
Right. I enjoyed this book a great deal. I'm a big fan of your books over the years. Are you working on something new now?
Well, I'm always working on something. Yeah, I'm doing a book on, or thinking about doing a book on the history of speed, rail speed, like speed records and so on. That it's quite an interesting story, particularly in the 1930s, the rivalry between Germany and Britain in particular. And, of course, that has led to the development of high-speed rail in many parts of the world, starting it with the Shinkansen in Japan and the bullet trains in France. So it's kind of an interesting story.
Right. How often do you take a train yourself, whether it's for leisure or to get places?
Well, not very often. I mean, I've been on the Fraser Valley Historical Heritage Railway a little while ago, but I don't need to go to Seattle, I suppose, so I don't take that one, and I don't go back east that much these days either. So, I wouldn't want probably to spend 3 or 4 days getting there. Unfortunately, it's more a leisure type of thing, I think, to be honest.
And I have looked into that because, as I said, I'm a big fan of trains, to taking them wherever I can. It is expensive to take the Via Rail, for example, if you just want to go to Alberta, even.
Yeah, I know. The problem is the volume isn't there anymore.
Right.
You know, fares are low when there's high volume, and there just isn't the volume. Like, particularly if you compare it to a lot of other places in the world, and in turn, there isn't the population density that drives the viability of that kind of railway, a proper high-speed passenger rail.
Yeah, it just makes me, as I read your book, Derek, just makes me long for it and wish that it was maybe a different era where one could see the province, north, south even, or even go up and down the island, be able to see it taking
Indeed,
a train.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember taking the PGE from North Vancouver up to, well, I went up to Lillooet once. I mean, it's a very, very spectacular journey in the Fraser Canyon.
Well, you've done a great service with this book, and it's such an enjoyable book as well. I appreciate your time today. It's nice to talk again.
Thank you, Joe.
The book is called Iron Road West, An Illustrated History of British Columbia's Railway. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Derek Hayes, joined me on the line from White Rock in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.